This is an oral history interview from Mystic Seaport Museum. The narrator is Mr. Rod Stevens. The interviewer is Fred Calabretta. We're at Mr. Stevens' home in Scarsdale, New York, and the date is August 16th, 1991. One thing I was interested in asking you about was your experience at Nevins.
Yes, I'm glad to tell you about.
And let's see, when you first went there, or you first met Henry Nevins?
Yes. It was the summer of 1928, and at that period, Olin was using the room in Nevins' office building for his own designing and work he was doing. And I did a little work for him, made some drawings and stuff, some calculations, and Henry Nevins was right below both of us. And one night, fall of the summer, late in the summer, I was leaving. He said, "Come in a minute." He said, "Maybe you'd be interested in working here." And I said, "Well, I would be." He said, "Well, I'd be glad to, if you could start in right now." And I said, "Well, I'm already going back for early football. I was very keen on football at that time. But I said, I am interested in what you say." He said, "There's a good chance here. So I will drive to Ithaca and I talk to the dean and see if I can come in, get a leave of absence, and then I might be able to do this. If I don't like it, I'll go back, because I'd finished my freshman year with in good standing. I didn't want to throw it away." So I got in the car and drove to Ithaca, talked to the dean, and he said, "You can certainly have a leave of absence because you're in good standing, but," he said, "if you do that, you're not going to come back, and I don't really like that." And I said, "Well, that's a chance we'll have to face." And he was right in his guess, because I got involved in the work there, and it was a good chance because I knew all the people, because I've been around there summer a lot anyhow during the summer, and when I started to work there every day, they were very pleasant and helpful to me, and a lot of them were very competent people. And so I had a chance to work in different parts of the yard, in the, especially in the mold loft where we took the lines and drew them out full size on the floor prior to building forms and so forth. And I could work quite with the rigor, which I was very interested in, enjoyed, learned a lot from all of them. They were all very pleasant to me. And so I worked off and on till the spring of 33, when business was not very good, and I had become intrigued with the idea of sailing over to Norway. So we just knew of a friend in Oyster Bay who'd spent time in Norway and said it was a lovely country and that a lot of beautiful girls and stuff like that. So we organized a trip to sail from City Island to Bergen, sail around the Norwegian coast, primarily to go back for the Fastnet race. That was 1933. We'd won the Fastnet race, was the race in 1931. So we thought it'd be fair enough if we'd won it once, we ought to go back again, give them another shot at us, give us another shot too. So we organized this, and Mr. Nevins wasn't disappointed at all if I was going to take the summer off, because there things were pretty quiet. And so myself, Ducky Ent, Sherman Hoyt, Porter Buck, and a schoolmate who was not a sailor named Dave Leeson. I'd known him during high school here in Scarsdale, played in the same football team, and he would only come as cook. Nobody particularly likes to cook. And so that we organized this trip, and I got a leave of absence, and we took off in May, I think, from City Island, bound for Bergen. And we had a good trip over and got to Norway, had a lot of good times, and sailed around the Norwegian coast and went on from Hankø, which is down on the Oslo Fjord, took off for England for the Fastnet to get the boat hauled out and polished and for the Fastnet race, which was starting in August. So the same five of us Dave Leeson, Sherman Hoyt, Porter Buck, Ducky Ent, and myself, we sailed from Hanko, Norway, to Solent, England, and got the boat hauled out at Lymington, bottom polished, and sailed the Fastener race, which we fortunately won that again, which was nice. And after that was over, we sailed home. And that on that overall trip, I got the Cruising Club Blue Water Medal because we had a good trip. We two transatlantic passages, the Fastener race, which we won again.
And that trip to Norway, that point in your career was when you made your break full time from Nevins.
No, it was after I got back from that. Then I was really more interested in the boats we were building. We were building a number of boats of Olin's design, 6 meters and so forth. And then it was a while after that I was back working at Nevins the regular way. And then I said I'm really more interested in what we're doing for Olin. And he'd gotten pretty busy then, and he said there'd be plenty of work to keep me busy. He then had an office across the street from Nevins on City Island Avenue, right opposite Nevins. And so it was somewhat after the return from Europe, from this trip, that I made my break with Nevins.
And what was it, do you think, that made Henry Nevins a good boat builder? What was he doing right?
Well, he was had a very interesting idea. He said, he sometimes people were fussing about how to do this and do that. He said, number one, you do it the best way you know how to do it and do it right. He says, I'll worry about getting paid for the job. His rates were high. Everybody thought they were terribly high and unreasonable, but he didn't bother him at all. He said, you do it right. Do it carefully. You made a mark. He didn't do a rough mark. He wanted a very accurate line. You don't just write a quick mark and cut near, but you make an accurate line and cut to it. A little thing, but he was right about that, of course. And the best thing of all was that Rufus Murray, who he'd gotten from Harrishoff's in Bristol, Rufus Murray was the superintendent, and he and I hit it off very well. I spent most of my time with him. Whenever we go off to buy some lumber, I'd go with him. He was a tremendous authority on, he could identify, there are many kinds of oak, and to most of us they all look about the same, but from a half a mile away he could tell you what was white oak, what was yellow bark, and what was black, and what a piss oak and pin oak. I never knew how many kinds, there were a great many, but I loved this guy Murray. He was quiet, friendly, and everybody admired him, and he taught me an awful lot.
Well, that must have been a great opportunity for you to work
yes.
with him at that age. And
he was such a nice man. Quite elderly, but always in a good humor.
And where would you go on your lumber buying trips with him?
Well, a lot of we got at Nyack across the Hudson River. Yeah. There was one big place there. And Murray would put little marks on the logs he picked out. And when the truck came in with all these logs on, he'd look at them quick and say, yes, those two we won, but those, forget them. And it was a great experience to be with him. He was so nice to work with, and he knew what he was doing so well. He was in every part of the yard.
And he was knowledgeable about all the construction phases.
Yes, because he'd been educated by Nat Harrishoff, and there's none better than that in the world. And so he knew a lot about the details of boat building and how it should be done right.
So he really was responsible for bringing a lot of that Harrishoff tradition to Nevins.
That's right. Nevins had patterns for the Harrishoff anchor, which was like a regular kedge anchor, but the pads were, instead of being having corners on, they were diamond shaped, so the line wasn't so apt to catch and trip the anchor out. And they had a wonderful pattern shop where they could make pattern for anything, and I'd go with Mario Place in Stamford, where they mold these things, and this quality was very good there, because a lot of cast bronze things were not too strong, but what he got, he saw, checked them out, checked the patterns, checked the castings, and they were very good quality, and that was a fortunate experience.
Are there any specific things that he said or words of advice or his philosophy that you really kind of carried with you, you know, through your career, or any specifics really, or just his
overall? Well, specifically that it's got to be done right, no matter what, no compromise. And that I got from Mr. Nevins. Murray agreed completely with that. Never any difference of opinion.
Who was the rigger at head rigger at Nevins at that time?
The most amusing fellow named Bob Hinkelman, of German background, and a very strong fellow. And I said, "Bob, how much could you really lift?" And he said, "Goddamn, if the stuff under me was strong, I could lift anything. But normally my feet just go down, and it's real heavy. I got a kick out of that." And we had all of us had to make out timesheets. And one of Bob's that amused me particularly was, 4 hours looking for a ladder, 4 hours couldn't find the ladder. I went into his day's work, Monday or Tuesday, whatever day it was. He was a great guy. He knew his trade beautifully. And I remember it, 1 year after I'd bought the New York 32, which was, became Mustang, he got me, the boat had been hauled out, the mast been stored, and all the standing rigging was taken off. And he said, "I want you to see something, because you wouldn't believe me otherwise you didn't see it firsthand." So he took several of the lower end of the shrouds, which were spliced 1x19. At that time, they used a lot of 1x19 spliced. They weren't too keen on these true lock fittings because they weren't put on right. They weren't any good. But he said, "I want you to see this, because maybe you wouldn't believe me if I showed you later." So he took one of these. It was a thimble for a turnbuckle. The turnbuckle was away, and it was served with wire. And he took it, and he, very, just like this, he bent it about 90 degrees, and then he took the wire off it, and most of the strands inside had broken where he bent them. And he said it shouldn't be really spliced at all, although Nevin was doing it, they were carefully spliced. But the trouble is the wire fatigues a little, where when loads comes on, where it's tucked, load come on would probably bend it just a little under fatigue. It does fatigue very quickly. Because when we were serving with stainless wire, you never had a cut. You just went around and it came off. And so I learned quite a lot from Bob Hinkelman. And we got away, said, "No more 1x19 spliced. And you can't use the hot sockets because you're heating the stainless more than it wants to be heated." So we went to True Lock Fittings, and Kretzer's still on City Island. They had a machine shop, and they had a fellow who was pretty good at putting those fittings on, and as long as he did it carefully, they were very good, and you had to inspect them. And if you get any cracks on them, which develop on the longitudinal cracks on the barrel of the fitting, then they had to be abandoned because they lost much of their strength. Should be replaced as soon as you can see those cracks. Some of them, sometimes just a tool mark, that means nothing, but you could put a little dye on it, and if it really went into it, then replace it.
Was there always an adequate supply of lumber and building materials at Nevins? Were they always able to get what they needed?
Yes, there's no question about that. They had good spar spruce and the white oak that Murray chased up, and I was with him and going over there across the river. I don't remember the name of the company, but it was in the lumber business, and that's where we got most of the white oak. And the only oak that he'd use was real white oak, and that's the only kind that should be used. The other brands look just about the same, but if you take a little piece of it, and about maybe 3 inches long, and you blow in one end, put the other end in the water, little bubbles come out, that's not white oak. And that came to advantage. We're having a boat built by Knutson and Huntington. They had a good boat building business. And I was concerned with what they put in the keel, that it wasn't white oak. And I got a little piece of it, and you could blow through it. And so I got Mr. Newson to give me a piece, which I mailed out to the Forest Products Laboratory in Madison, somewhere in Wisconsin. It was one government agency that I had a lot of respect for. They knew their business, and I got a thing back. I asked them to call me collect when they'd looked it over. They said, that's not white oak. And I got Knudsen to agree, so the whole boat was set up. The keel there, floor timbers on it, and starting putting frames in. But I give him credit for it. He didn't fight against it. He agreed that he would go by what they said. Their report was it was not white oak. And he took that thing apart and replaced the keels from the ground up.
When Nevins started building Sparkman and Stevens designs, how did your relationship shift there? Or you would still spend time there during the construction process?
Yes. Well, I had charge of several boats that were being built, Sparkman and Stevens design. I spent most time on laying stuff out and following up the construction, and it didn't change any, all except I was really more interested in the Sparkman and Stevens boats than the boats we were building for Rose or Alden or anybody else.
And did the people at Nevins, did they welcome your input? And were you?
Well, I was surprised. They seemed very glad that I was there. They helped me with tools. They gave me advice about everything. They're a very high-class bunch of people.
I wanted to ask you if you would describe or summarize your involvement and your role with a typical Sparkman and Stevens design, and how you would first get involved in the design phase.
Well, first get involved when I was at Nevins. The first thing I get involved in was the mold loft work, laying the thing out full size on the floor, and then. There was a wonderful Nils Halverson. He died not so long ago, but he was a remarkable fellow. He was very bad eyesight, and he was doing all the Moloff work. You say that wasn't good for him, but I've seen right down on the floor to see these lines, and he sure knew how to lay the lines down full size. And he and Rufus Murray were both very helpful. Sometimes they'd say, look, you don't want to put a 3/4-inch bolt through that little piece of wood, you're just going to break the wood off there. And that we listened to very much because we had admiration for Murray and Nils Halverson, and weren't against getting a phone call from them and saying, those you call for 3/4-inch bolts, the stem scarf, they'd be much better, 3/8 or 9/16 or 1/2 inch or something like that. And we listened to that, and we were pleased to get that input. And it helped the quality of the boats. I don't know how much they did that for other designs, but I know they did it for us, and we were very glad to get that input.
And then as the boat took shape and was built, you would continue to spend a considerable amount of time.
Yeah.
And what sorts of things would you be doing and looking out for?
Well, I still remember quite well. There were 2 6-meters we built for 2 friends in Chicago. The boats were identical on paper. They had different numbers and different names. And when they were launched, I'd gotten everything together and been on the boat to see they had the jib sheets and they had the halyards all right and everything, the backstay stuff and all that. And I remember sailing trials on those boats and many other boats too, and I enjoyed sailing the trials. And I do the same in Sparkman and Stevens. They didn't pay as much attention to an Alden or a Rhodes boat, but as they were Sparkman and Stevens, I cut everything together so the boat was ready to go and sail it in trials.
Did you have a set routine that you used over the years when you were out on trial trips and
No, I accumulated notes, which I kept summarized. I had various lists of things to look out for, and I'd pay attention to them.
So it would depend on what kind of boat
what
it was.
What type of boat it was, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the things that you were most concerned about on a trial trip?
One of the, it's a little thing, but very important, that the steering gear, wheel steering, that most of the bigger boats, it's got to be very free. And I used a figure of 1 foot-pound, and I had a knife that I wore, and it weighed about a pound, and I put that a foot out, put the wheel straight ahead in still water, hang it 1 foot out from the center, and if it didn't turn the wheel, that was not satisfactory. That's one of the hardest things to get. And I've been kind of irritated since I haven't been there and haven't made some trials. We had a couple of our new boats, which are really very nice boats built by Palmer Johnson, but one of them particularly was very stiff to turn. You can't, that's not, nobody's no fun. I'd put a boat on auto like that on autopilot and I wouldn't touch the wheel. But when it's right and you put your finger near the spoke and turn with one finger, that's 1 foot-pound. Very hard to get. And I remember a funny story. When a very nice New England named Bill Sims, he's no longer living, but he had a yard in the outskirts of Boston, down towards Lawley's, and he built a motor sailor for Mike Vanderbilt after Ranger and after he'd been sailing with him for a couple of years. And Mike was the very one of the wheel to be absolutely free. And we went out, we started to go out for trials, and the boat was all ready to go, and Mike up at the bridge, and he said, "Mr. Sims, you're not going out today." He says, "When you get this wheel free, you call me up, we'll come again." He was very anxious to get the trials, and there was a fair amount of money outstanding. And that was amusing. And Sims was a very competent, and his brother Eric, the second in command, and was very much in all the mechanical stuff. And I could tell Bill talking to Eric, "Got to get this goddamn thing just as free." So we went back to South Station, took the train back to New York, and about midday the next day, he called me, he said, "Rod, you can tell your friend Vanderbilt that this thing is as smooth as it can ever be, and you can come up and you have trials, we'd like to have them." So I said, "Great, glad if you got it smooth, 1 foot-pound or less." "Yes." And so we went up, and the first thing he got on the bridge, and it was neat. And that boat was a kind of a fat motor sailor and been owned by several different people, but everybody talks about what a nice boat to steer, not the design.
They but remember the steering?
One of our smaller boats, owned by a dentist in Rochester, awfully nice man. He was quite a good mechanic, too, with the stuff he done in teeth. He knew what it was to make things fit and all that. And that boat, he worked, when it was finished, I was a little disappointed in the gear. It wasn't as free as it should be. It was a small boat, about a 40-footer. But after the winter, he said, "I think you like the way this feels now." And boy, that thing was just blowing the breeze. And that boat, whoever's been on it, anyways, that's the nicest steering boat, nothing to do with Sparkman, Stevens, or any, or the builder, but is the owner. I forget his name, I'm ashamed to say. But that's one of the difficult things to get and a very important thing.
What were some of the other things that you paid particular attention to?
Well, a bilge pump system. I have a feeling that the average boat owner, the professionals, they like an electric bilge pump. In my opinion, there should never be an electric bilge pump on any boat ever, because if you're in trouble, it'll run the battery down and you can't run the motor if you really need it. And it doesn't handle enough water. And I liked a good Edson hand pump, 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 pump. You could discharge about like that.
Hmm. Did you, when you were on trials, did you keep notes and keep a clipboard handy or something? How did you keep track of things? And Did you have any set routine?
No, no set routine, no.
Uh-huh.
But after the trials are over, then I do a lot of thinking, and I can pretty well reconstruct everything that bothered me and try to get it taken care of.
How long would it usually take if you did have to, from a trial trip like that, if you did have to make certain adjustments and things, how long would generally take for that to be completed to the point where you were satisfied?
A couple of days to a couple of weeks, depending on the yards.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Abakan Rasmussen in Germany, when the early trial with them, there was a long list of things, and I thought it would be a couple of weeks, and the owner of the boat was already a little late, and he was kind of mad because his people were living in a hotel at his expense, and I asked them how long it would take, and they said, well, we'll have day after tomorrow at noontime be finished. They had a lot of manpower. They were well organized, and they took the list, and they didn't disagree with anything, and they put the men who knew how to do it, fix this. And so it went anywhere from a couple of days to some of them never did get around to it, and they'd stall. The owner was always in a hurry to get the boat.
How would you describe your relationship with clients and owners over the years? Always friendly and
I'd say about 98% friendly. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I guess there are always a couple people here and there who are never satisfied.
That's right. I was always strongly against anybody trying to take some legal action because that's silly. You just irritate the builder, you irritate yourself, you waste money. Lawyers are going to be paid a lot of money and forget it. And they didn't go for it too much, but a couple of times it worked well.
How did you deal with a situation where an owner kind of insisted on something that you didn't think was a good idea?
Well, if he insisted enough, that has to have to be.
Mm-hmm. But you do your best to...
Yeah. I'd start to begin with, in our own office, try to keep things simple. That's a hard thing to sell. Anybody decide to spend X dollars for a boat which he wants to be a real winner, they want all these things, they go to a boat show and grab everything they can see, never mind what it costs or the trouble of installing it, how it makes it difficult for maintaining the things you need. That's why I don't like too much, especially too much electrical stuff. That's, of course, changed so much. Nowadays, they all have everything electronic.
Was there, of course, with the electronics and everything, that's relatively new, but in the 30s, even then, were there people that some of the owners who still wanted things a little more complicated than they needed to be?
Well, the first thing they wanted was greater direction find. They were never too keen for them, but they certainly seemed a nice idea just to turn and learn where you were supposed to be. And I remember the first time I really got interested in that, we were coming back. In that 1933, when I took the summer off when things were quiet, we'd been to Norway, won the Fastnet race, and sailed back home. And on the way home, we were coming along the backside of Cape Cod. It was foggy. We had seen one thing, a black can buoy cultivated a shoal. It's near the banks, a little beyond Cape Cod, about maybe 75 miles away from Cape Cod. And strange enough, we sailed right up to this can buoy, no sound, no nothing, and we just hit it right ahead, and then it got very foggy, and went on, and so as we were coming back, what was presumably along the backside of the cape, but we couldn't see anything, and it was fairly deep, I had a little sounding machine that the fellow made, the Walker Logs, with a personal friend, and he'd given it to me after the Fastnet race. And it had a little, you put your own lead on it. It had a little propeller that spun when you started to pull it up, and then something locked it so it wouldn't record all the way down, but didn't change it when you pulled it back up. And we were using that and getting some depth of, I think it was a couple hundred feet. And so it was quite a job. And one of the crew was in charge of the radio and said, this is too damn much work. I got a better scheme. So he got a a paper. Got that?
Okay.
Out on North Street, New Rochelle, on our way over there, and I didn't have the phone number with me.
Oh. I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but it sounds like you just had a birthday.
Yeah. The girl you saw downstairs, there we have three girls here from Guatemala. It must be a wonderful country. These girls are damn nice. They're very competent. They drive the car well, and they work very hard on anything. And this was a complete surprise. And it just shows how if someone's not expecting it, you can get away with a lot. There were two strange cars in the driveway. I didn't even think, and the young boy who was very nice, they were in on it. And when we were coming back from the supermarket, we were coming too quickly, they go up to the school. We didn't know why. We thought we'd do what they say. So fortunately, by following their directions, we got right into the house before I even dreamt anything was going on. Went to the kitchen, and this happy birthday thing was there. Everybody had hats on, and they had noisemakers. It was neat. And this is one thing that came from it.
And you had a couple of other pretty good sailors in the house?
Yes, the son of one of these girls. I'd been invited to sail on a Swan 47, a boat called Till, Dr. Klein. And I said, "Susie, could I ask a very special favor? There's a young boy that I think is in a class by himself. I'd like to get him on the boat." He said, "You bring him. He's 8 or 9 years old." And it was a great success. It took 5 minutes for him to learn how to steer by the compass with a big wheel. And I was just over at his house yesterday after we had the damn trouble with the car, and he went to an art class. He's been making lots of little sketches and things. And gee, he'd made a picture. It was up on it's a thing you can't frame yet because it takes quite a while for the paint to harden. I don't know. I didn't know about that. But anyhow, it looks better than a professional picture. And he just, first time he's ever done, mostly he makes little sketches. And he's such a nice boy.
And did you say that Arthur Knapp and the Hibberds were here?
Yes, or? Arthur Knapp and the fellow makes these radio-controlled models. He has a very beautifully built model of the current type of boat that's supposed to race the America's Cup. And it's about that long, and it's very light and very well built, very strong, because he was heading a pond down here near our house, and the servo on his rudder control was out of order. You can't fix it, you have to replace it. So he tried to sail it without that and without the rudder control. It wasn't very practical. And it sailed quite fast into the dam, which didn't bother anything. It hit keel, hit several rocks. It didn't. It's so strongly built, it doesn't weigh hardly anything. And he was back at the party with the boat out. His car was in the driveway. He has a van which puts the boat in the back of it, takes the rig out, and the boat doesn't take too much space. And he can carry Arthur around and get him into the van. And we have a wheelchair, which I saved from when my wife had been sick. And instead of paying something, I said, "I want to buy the damn thing." And I'm so glad I did, because Arthur Knapp, if someone will bring him here, then he can't. On most of the small cars that we have today, you can't get the wheelchair in, and any people, too. So anybody can bring him over and get out of the car, get the wheelchair in the garage. And then we take and wheel them anywhere around. So he was here, and the Hibberds were here. And this boy who was such a good sailor, and his little sister was my girlfriend. She's about 9 weeks old now, 9 months old, I guess it is. Yeah, not quite a year, and she's the cutest thing. There's a picture in back there. Maybe it's in my pocket. Yeah, I have it.
Oh,
that's the girl, and that's her brother. And that's the guy that learned this. The people on the boat just couldn't believe it. The thing is, he did exactly what I tell him. I said, now look, Eric, you're going to turn the wheel as little as you have to, but don't wait. If you get off, correct it. But when you're right, you'll hold it right on. And he could go for 30 or 40 minutes without being 1 degree off the course. You asked him to steer, which people couldn't believe it. He'd never been on a sailboat before. And he went to art class 2 nights ago. He's made a picture with some trees and water and a mountain in the background with snow on it. And they have quite a nice picture in there. And this is much better than the nice picture they have, which for his first try. So he's quite, that's Eric, and this is Dollard.
There's, you know, when you mention Arthur Knapp and people like Ed Grafe and Lorna Hibbard, there are probably a lot of people who would like to be a fly on the wall when some of you sit down and start talking
about
sailing.
Those are really remarkable people, because I really think there's no better sailor than Arthur Knapp, and never has been, never will be. He can go on anything from a frostbite dinghy to a J-boat and help right there.
When you get together with people like that, does the conversation at times shift to some of the great experiences you had in the 30s, for example, or in those times? And
well, we come back to our first meeting with Arthur Knapp. His father was vice commodore of the Larchmont Yacht Club, and Drayton was a new boat just launched. We were going to the Bermuda race. And somebody was smart enough to say, listen, Mr. Stevens, you ought to get this fellow Knapp to go with you. He could help you quite a lot. And Father was delighted. We were all delighted. We didn't know anything about him at the time, but he signed on as a member of the crew, and it was a tremendous education, because I don't think we ever cleared the sheet during all the way from New London, where that race started, to Bermuda. But his thing was, don't just cleat and sit down there. Was play a little, eat a little, in a little, talking about an inch or half an inch. And that was a good lesson. And we talk about that often. I tell him many times that he was responsible for anything good that thought of us as sailors. And we never had a disagreement of any kind. I worked with him. He wrote a book, Race Your Boat Right. And I worked on that department before we built this house. And the only thing he wasn't too happy about, he had to leave his cigars outside.
Had a no-smoking rule.
Yeah.
And Lorna Hibbard was a great sailor.
She was a wonderful sailor. And we had having a dinner for her at the American Yacht Club a year and a half ago, and I was saying just a few words, and I said, I'll tell you an interesting statistic. I think that every time she sailed on Mustang, we've always running the American Yacht Club cruise, whatever, or New York Yacht Club and port to port. And I think any time she's been on the boat, we have always won. She always starts the boat. She always is responsible for tactics. She's in a class by herself.
I think she was one of the, if I'm not mistaken, one of the first women to sail in a Bermuda race on stormy weather. Is that
true? That's true, yes. Because she knew the Laboot Lair quite well. She was working at Best and Company and so forth. And she did sail that. I would say that was not her forte. She didn't especially like the rough weather, but she did sail and was very helpful. And as I say on these day runs and stuff on Mustang, though it's my boat, I say, Lorna, you're starting and you're running the show. And never had any disagreement. Same with Arthur Knapp.
Some great sailors, that's for sure.
Olin, in my opinion, is by far the best of all Arthur Knapp, Lorna Hibbert, anybody you want to say. And the same thing on my boat. I say, now you're running things. Just tell me what you want, we'll do it. His judgment is so good.
Did you ever feel frustrated, yourself or Olin, that you couldn't spend more time either cruising or racing, you know, as Sparkman and Stevens became more and more successful?
No, I was a little sorry that I couldn't use the boat enough to really justify keeping it when we finally did sell it, but that was last year or so. There were quite a few weekends we didn't even take it off the mooring, and I didn't like that at all. When we first got it, every Friday night we were there. Every Sunday evening we got back and came home. No.
And was your work something that you've always enjoyed doing?
No question about that. Because for all the years I worked there, and been quite a few, I've pretty near always been there by 6 or 6:30 in the morning. And that was only because I enjoyed the work and enjoyed what I was doing. I liked to have time to think things through. And
And there never was a time when you just felt that maybe you needed a break from boats for a
never,
while.
never, never, never a second or a moment.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about sales and your involvement with Ratsy, for example.
But we had a very good relationship with Ratsy there, right next to Nevins there at City Island. And in the 30s, they were the number one sailmaker, pretty generally accepted as such. And I could just go right to their place. And one thing they liked, if they did anything for me, they got a first-hand report, not a lot of baloney, but what I tell them, they would believe what I said if I said the leech was tight or the leech was slack or the luff needed to be tensioned more. In fact, I begged them to leave the wire out of the luff but general jib for good news. It didn't succeed because they hadn't ever done it before. The sail was not very good, but it was about 5 or 10 years before they began to make the so-called stretchy luff. And so most anything, we didn't disagree on anything at all. And I knew the foreman there, and I could take a sail over to him and say, "Would you ease the top batten a little and do so and so?" And they do what I asked. And we had a very good relationship, and the sails were excellent, had a lot to do with our general good performance. Mustang had a very good racing record. I know Mrs. John Nicholas Brown wrote a article, I think for Rudder, I'm not sure. But she mentioned of all the boats the Bolero had raced against, the only one which was kept ahead of her, plus and minuses, was Mustang. It kind of amused me. I didn't realize, and I believe it was true. And the fact was, not that anything special about Mustang or anything special about, but we had a wonderful crew, and very seldom did we say anything, just do what had to be done and just do it, have any disagreement, because everybody had the same ideas about almost everything, and that produced a good racing record.
It sounds as though with to hear you speak of Nevins and Ratsey's and that there was just a wonderful relationship there
Yeah,
that was beneficial to
that's
everybody.
correct. Yes.
And
The only
just
thing that bothered me a little was that a lot of the people got new sails every year, and I always got a new sail only when there was a chance to get a better sail for the job. And the old sails were always worked on every winter, and I had great belief in doing that. But there were a lot of paid hands who were getting some kickback, no doubt. And many times they replaced sails just because they were dirty or a little mildew or something. And I just thought, that's a shame to do that, but you can't stop it.
did you ever work with Ratsy or kind of consult with them concerning sales for boats other than S&S boats
Oh,
or?
yes. Well, not for other designers, no, but for any boat we were sailing on, we worked with Ratsy on it, tell them what we thought was good about it, what ought to be done to it, what was could be improved, and they would listen to what we said, because I think they and the people in their shop figure that we knew what we were talking about, and so that made a very good relationship.
How did you learn what you came to know about sails and sail making? Something.
Just more or less paying attention to the obvious. You know, you can look at a sail and you can see if it's just if the leech is falling off, it's got to be taken in some. If it's tight, it makes the weather helm, drags the boat, slows the boat down. So as a result of working a lot on the leech not being too tight, not being too loose, and then we got quickly into the stretchy luff headsails, so that Mustang in particular always sailed with mainsail general that were very good for the condition. And we had the minimum of sails, couldn't afford. A lot of people have too many, and I couldn't afford anything more than just about what I need to have.
Did how would you we've talked about Nevins, but how would you summarize your relationships with builders in general over the years?
In general, it's been very satisfactory. Most of them don't take offense to what I urge them to do. A lot of them, however, would be just as soon as they could just take the plans and forget about it. And that didn't suit me very well. In other words, particularly the common building, Aberkeen Rasmussen, for example, they wouldn't mind if I, they, in fact, they, some designs would never show up. They sent them a pretty poor set of plans. This fellow named Holland put that there at all. He's a bum designer. He's designed a lot of winning boats because they build them too light. They've had keels fall off half a dozen of them. It doesn't seem to worry him. They don't sell any decent plans, so he's very much in the hands of the sailmaker. And the sailmakers like that, and the builders like it too. And that distresses me a certain amount. That was never a problem with us.
So you, over the years, have traveled an awful lot
I
and
have really, I'm sorry, I never kept track of it.
spent a lot of time at the various yards. And
Yes.
are there any major general differences between, say, the foreign builders and the American builders?
Not really. There's a little difference in that the climate in Europe is better for the wooden construction than it is in this country. Here we pretty cold winters and pretty dry periods and so on. The European builders, they can build boats without any caulking at all and glued seams, and if they don't really dry out, they never leak at all, and they're just fine. But if you leave one out in the hot sun for a month or two in May or June or July, they have damage because when the stuff shrinks, it splits. Yeah, pulls itself, destroys itself. And in Europe, they do a lot more tight planking with no caulking, and they the weather in Europe is better. But several very well-built European boats that never leaked a drop have come over here and had quite a lot of trouble. That's an interesting point.
Just twist it a little bit. Did I wondered if I read or heard that I guess Harold Vanderbilt, on a couple of occasions, he and others would go into the Rosenfeld photographers' offices and study photographs. And I wondered if you had ever, you observation was something you did very well and was a big part of what you did. And I wondered if you ever used if photographs were ever any use to you in evaluating
Terrific use.
performance.
Unfortunately, Mike Vanderbilt could afford to get just about any group of pictures that he thought might be helpful, and we were delighted we couldn't do it and wouldn't do it. But we'd love to be able to do it. And we spent a lot of hours with Mike Vanderbilt, Arthur Napoleon, and I looking over pictures of different sails. And one very interesting thing on Ranger, one of the key parts was a sail book, which every sail that we set and used there. At the end of the day, there were comments on that sail. How much short of the band was it? 2 or 3 inches or whatever. Mike was anxious that every sail be just about full of the band when it was setting properly.
How would you summarize those experiences of sailing with Mike Vanderbilt and
Well, he was very, two things that impressed me very much. He was very good in the weather, particularly off of Newport in that area. Another thing which indicates the way his mind worked, when we came in for a sail, the mainsail was always taken off, even though it was the sail we used 9 days out of 10. Again, nice day, then looks like a nice day tomorrow. We pick up the mooring right and mainsail into the. That was quite a lot of work for all of us, but we knew he was right, so we didn't mind it. We kind of took our hats off to him. Next day, the same thing, come out, we put the slides on the boom and slides on the mast, and off we'd go. The other thing was that no matter how we were winning races and there wasn't anything wrong with the boat, but he always was going to sail tomorrow, even though we won the last 10 races and nothing important, but nobody grudged him that. He was so right. And we always learned. Every day we went out, we learned a little something, and maybe helped a little bit the next day when we might have needed it.
And stayed sharp.
Yes, that's so. I admired that. And there were things we often, as members of the crew, we thought we needed to have more spinnakers or whatever. And Mike occasionally turned us down, but when in retrospect, any time he didn't go for what we were trying to sell him, we generally had to admit a few weeks later that he was quite right. He didn't just get things because he had the money. He got things because they might help us. And we admired that quality in Oldman and Nappy and myself. We were all in with him on that. And if we really got our stumbling block, we had a good anchor to wonder. We get Mrs. Vanderbilt, who was very helpful. We say, listen, Gertie, you got to get Mike to come around to this certain sale that we need. And by God, about a day or so later, we get an order for that sale. So that was interesting, sort of teamwork.
She'd put in a good word for you.
Yeah, she was very helpful when we really needed it.
You've had so many special sailing experiences and been associated with so many outstanding boats and people. Is there any particular period or anything that stands out? You know, when you look back over your career, that was really more special than another time or any particular race or.
Well, there was a period. There was a builder which I had never heard of at all, and he got an order from three of our clients to build a boat each year, to build another boat around 40 feet. And the firm was named the Brothers Martins, Brudner Martinson, was a Swedish firm. And when I first heard of them, there was a client we'd been writing to. I was at Plym's Yard, which is certainly one of the very best builders ever been in existence. And this man came down. He said, I'm glad to catch you here. He said, can you go with me tomorrow to the builder who I'm going to give a contract for my new boat? I said, why not here? And he said, well, I want to do it in Martinson's. So I met him the next day, and we drove out to Martinson's. And they're it's hard to say a best builder, but they pretty near belong there. And they were so darn good. They could do anything and do it always right. And they would do anything I asked them to, and they'd be a little more apt to do it my way than Abbeking and Rasmussen or Palmer Johnson. They have a lot of their own opinions and their own knowledge. These fellows, if I said to do it this way, they did it this way. And I still remember the third boat that builder, the third and last boat, he more or less priced himself out of work, because it's hard to explain to the client that this guy is much better than anybody else. And he was. The last boat we had trials, I'll never forget it. I couldn't even find a cotter pin that had the sharp edges round around. They opened the right amount, not too much, and not turned the wrong way, because they listened to what I said. And the third was a summer of three going that boat called AJA. It was such a good boat. I said, it's too bad to put this boat out in the ocean. We ought to put it in a museum somewhere. Everything about it was perfect. Because that's an experience I'll never forget. That boat, the man named Captain Bjornefeldt, and he didn't realize how good it was, but a typical thing, I've frequently had a difference with clients, because I think every boat should have a pivoting table, not gimbals, but pivoted sideways, not fore and aft. And most of them don't want it, because why? The ones they've been brought up with were boats that table was 4 feet wide and had a big long ballast at the bottom, hit everybody in the shins. And our idea was very different. They got to be damn narrow. They may not be as comfortable just for eating, but if they're narrow enough, they work like Irving Johnson's boat. His table, which was always a swing table, was only about so wide, plates here and plates there. And so this guy, Bjornefeldt, he didn't want to, he wanted to have the cabin free, so he didn't want it. And it was a 40-footer, and he'd be racing a lot. And I said, you really ought to have it. No. So I was going back for trials in 2 weeks. And I said, you got to make up your mind, because you got to be able to finish it. The one of the brothers, the four brothers, Bjorn, and he said, it's not a matter. Don't worry about it. And I said, how the hell are they going to finish it up? So I didn't worry about it, and I went home back to New York, made a date to meet them about 4 weeks hence. They were going to be in the water ready for trial, the sales would be delivered, so what they had done, they made the first and only pivoted swing table that could be collapsed in seconds. Not a complicated thing. They needed a chief engineer to take the damn thing apart because he came in there with the table. I thought, boy, he's not going to like that much. He said, look, and it was folded up against the bulkhead. That was a typical thing that impressed me very much because he got the swing table, he got the open cabin he wanted, he got both of what he wanted. And those guys could do it. Nobody else, Palmer, Johnson, Abbeking, Rathman, Sparkman, Stevens, forget it. This guy, Eric, was he could figure out how to make this hinge table and how you could take it apart. And when it was in place, it was absolutely solid because I don't think any flimsy. And this was very impressive to me. And I was regretted about 2 or 3 years later, he sold the boat to a Norwegian. I thought that guy ought to keep that boat until he's buried. But he didn't know how good it was. But that was one trial trip that I made notes. That was the first and only one where there wasn't anything to say because everything they'd heard the 2 years before, each boat had, first boat had quite a long list, second boat had a short list. This boat had no list. It did have one thing. The days of toilets, you could pump them overboard. That's history now, but anyhow, very important detail. When you make that arrangement, most builders put a big pipe way out over to the side and come back, and it held a lot to pump through, which is bad. And when the boat heels over, it no longer has any height. So I said, we wanted just a short pipe, but come in towards the center line and then turn and go back. Much better, correct. So the only thing in this boat was the toilet went back. I said, I hate to tell you this, but you got to try to do this my way, which they could do in a couple of hours. There was no trouble at all. And they just took that pipe out and made come in the way I wanted it to, circle and go back. No matter how the boat heeled, it never could back in it. The pipe was much shorter, so he only had to pump a little bit to get everything out of the vessel. So that was an interesting experience I'll never forget. And these brothers were very nice. They're married, and each time I came, Eric was one, I don't even remember all the names, but they each had a nice wife, and they'd take me to lunch, and it'd be the best damn lunch you'd ever have. So it was a very pleasant experience. And one that I tried to talk, I told them, why don't you go to see, get Mr. Plim, he's right here. He's the best damn builder you could find. He said, he lived near this yard, Martinson, Brendan Martinson.
Did you, I wondered how you felt and what your reaction was when you came back from winning the transatlantic race in 1931. That was quite a to-do for such a young group of men. And
I remember being impressed because we went all the way from the Battery to my grandfather's office and Stevens Fuel Company on 138th Street. Never had to stop for red light. That impressed me more than anything else. Because we had a good squad of bicycles ahead, and they stopped traffic and kept the lights green for us, and that impressed me more than anything else.
Wow.
And the political foul-draw, which didn't impress me too much.
How old were you then? In 1931, you were...
I was 21.
21.
Yes.
Were you uncomfortable with all that attention?
No, just I've enjoyed it. When the ship came in through quarantine, there was a tugboat with squirting, and we were taking off there. We didn't have to wait to go to the dock and get our bags clearing. We just brought right in and get into a car. We went to City Hall and did a little speech making, but not much. And then we got back in the car and went on up to 138th Street in the Bronx. I was impressed by the fact that we did nonstop.
Not one light.
That's what I remember the most.
Well, you must have felt like a celebrity at that tender age to be welcomed like that.
Yes.
Interesting. Has, with all the success you've had in design and the boat building business and racing and sailing. Has it ever been a burden, people putting demands on you? Or...
No burden at all. The only thing that bothers me at all is I still read things that I was credited doing, which I never did or could do or ever would do. And that bothers me just a little bit, but not very much.
What are some of the things that are along those lines that, you know, are there any major, you know, misconceptions or misinformation on the record about your career or Sparkman and Stevenson?
Well, people talk about how I went all around the rigging on the J boats without just hand over hand and stuff, and I did a little bit, but not a whole lot. And I don't like to be credited with things which are not totally true.
But is there anything else that you know, that as far as the record needs to be straightened out?
Not really, no.
I know one thing that you know, your work on the foredeck and everything is something that people do talk about and continue to marvel at, and people like, well, I have spoken with people like Arthur Knapp and Lorna Hibbert and Hoveys and so many other people who have sailed with you and still admire so much, you know, what you would do on a boat. And
main trouble is it bothers me so much to be physically in a position I can't do it now.
Yeah. Is there anything else about your about your sailing career and things that we should talk about now? Or we've covered a lot of territory.
One thing that I particularly enjoyed, I'm glad that I, two things that I did my first sailing invariably on boats without engine, so we're quite used to sailing in or out of anywhere. And the second thing is the navigation. I'm glad I didn't learn it this year, where they just push a couple of buttons and tell us within a couple hundred yards of where they are. I'm used to sweating it out with a hand lead. The first instrument that really interested me, there was a Raytheon made a seamanship contest and advertised in all the yachting magazines and for one of their fathometers. And I'd love to have that, and I think that thing works, and it's good. And so Bob Erskine, who was one of my main crew members and a very intelligent, very good fellow, and I said, Bob, let's work on this, see if we might be able to do something. So they said, you're in a powerboat, so-and-so, you can't start the motor, what do you do? And so, and we thought it through pretty carefully, and I remember it was probably 4 or 5 months later, I was in my apartment in Scarsdale before this house was built, and a fellow had a collect telegram, and I said, thanks, buddy, but I don't go for them. You can take that back where it came from. He said, I think maybe you'd want to think this over. And this was a notification Raytheon that I had won the seamanship contest and would get one of their Fathometer Junior, which I'd love to have and I couldn't afford. And so I said, okay, I'll pay a couple bucks for that telegram. And so the thing was delivered and we installed it and it worked as long as I had it. It had a weakness. The unit which sent out the signal was very short-lived, and so soon after I got it, they were going to stop it, and I bought about 8 or 10 of these units for $5 a piece, so I had the thing working beautifully, and I enjoyed that. But otherwise, I learned to be pretty good at swinging a lead, and I think it's a thing that's nice to be able to do. But today, if anybody sees it, they say, there's plenty of water there, you're all right.
Well, it's an advantage to in having learned without all the gadgets.
Yeah,
because
that's
then
right.
if your gadgets break or
yeah
don't work, then you can fall back on your
And I'm very grateful that my navigating, for example, George Mixter, who is anybody who's interested in navigation knows who he was. Well, first Bermuda race I was invited to go on, it was almost scratched because the fellow who was going to navigate was unable. And I had lunch with George Mixter because he said, That's nonsense. I can tell you how to do it, and you don't have to give up the race. Telling a young kid, I was then about 18. And we had lunch at the Yale Club. He wrote a lot of stuff. He even bought the tablecloth after he got through because he made so many notes on it. I was amused by that. But he knew so well he didn't make it unreasonably difficult. That if you go to class to learn navigation, some long-haired guy who spent years studying it makes it so damn complicated you don't want to bother. But he said it's perfectly simple. And so although I didn't navigate in that first Bermuda race, I did several years later. Olin usually navigated when then, but the first trip I took when he wasn't there, then I was navigating. And I've enjoyed it. And I found that I had fantastic eyesight until this stroke. And I have books in the cellar where I take 7 or 8 sights, and I never would average anything. I'd always work them out, see what they were. And some of them, they're 8 or 10 within a tenth of a mile, which meant they were pretty accurate. And at that time, a lot of people say you couldn't get that close. You can have your opinion.
But it's a skill you develop. And
I had God-given eyesight. And that bothers me now because I have to ask somebody else, what's that? What does it look like? Where is it? On Ranger, there was never a mark that we had to go around that I wasn't the first one on the vessel that saw it. And Zine Bliss, the navigator, he knew that, so I could eat out of my hand because I said, Zine, yeah, you got to keep me fixed up all right. Because he welcomed that ability. I say, I can see it's about 5 degrees to starboard or whatever. That eyesight was good, and learning to sail with no damn motor was good.
One thing I thought was interesting when we talked a few years ago at the seaport, that I asked you then what you thought an important quality and for somebody on a boat to have, would be it the helmsman or somebody else, and you mentioned that you thought vigilance was at sea.
One of my father's friends in the coal business, and he made the first trip we made from Rye to Edgartown, and he very soon managed Charlie Dayton, but he was a very intelligent fellow. He sailed all his life. He told me, he said, the eternal vigilance is the price of safety. That got a little spot in my head, and I'm glad it's there. Eternal vigilance is the price of safety. Try to keep my eyes around.
Well, is there anything else you can think of right now?
I think we pretty well covered it.
Okay. Well, that's great.